Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Maggie, and the officers of the Domestic Institute chapter here at KU for having me. I look forward to sharing this talk with you and the conversations to follow. For ease of listening, I'll generally omit references, but you can ask me about them later. The title of the talk is Searching for Happiness, Pathfinding, and Pitfalls. We are all searching for happiness. I'll use happiness in this talk in the sense of a good life. Who of you would not say that you want a good life? When I refer to a good life, I'm not speaking like your professors do if they give you a B and say your work is good. For our purposes, the good life lacks nothing. It's the A-plus life, the best human life. Who of you would not say that you want to live your best life? Given we are all searching for happiness in this sense, and given its nature isn't obvious, it's important that we think carefully about what happiness is and how to get it. The claim the Greek philosopher Aristotle advances is that there is just one path to it. This may sound strange to you. You might object that happiness is different for each person and that it's up to each person to find his or her own happiness. But what if your best life is also everyone's best life? Aristotle thinks so, and it's worth our seeing why he thinks so. I'll explain Aristotle's account of the path to happiness, as well as how we might respond to this objection that his view doesn't account for the diversity of ways to happiness. Along the way, I'll also explain some alternative views of happiness, or supposed paths to reach it, that he rejects. I'll then press Aristotle's account and argue that while his view is on the right track, we can modify it to make it more plausible. I'll also present a critique of his view from the philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas, who argues that our happiness, astonishingly, requires an even higher standard than Aristotle thought. I'll present his view as well. While it goes beyond Aristotle's view, it builds on it. With a clear view of this path to happiness, I'll discuss how to walk down this path and avoid some pitfalls. In particular, I'll discuss an application of this view of happiness to eating food and drinking alcohol. Food and drink are daily and regular parts of a human life. Getting our relationship to food and drink wrong is a significant impediment to our living well. Getting it right will help us to live well each day. Aristotle on happiness. Aristotle, born in 384 and dying in 322 BC, was an Athenian philosopher who lived during the Golden Age of Greece. He was the student of Plato, who was the student of Socrates. He wrote learned treatises on a great number of subjects. These treatises were so insightful and penetrating that some of them exerted significant influence on Western civilization and to this day. To help you appreciate his significance, imagine if when you came to university, you found that the same author had written your textbooks for all your philosophy classes, as well as your constitutional law class, biology class, zoology class, psychology class, physics class, poetry class, and rhetoric class. He's worth paying attention to. Even if you think he's mistaken about happiness, he'll still be helpful for our thinking about it. I'll draw from his work, The Nicomachean Ethics, for this discussion. We'll begin with Aristotle's observation that every person acts for an end. People act for purposes and goals. Sometimes they do something for its own sake. These are called ends, by Aristotle. They also do things for the sake of other ends. These are called means. For example, you may have as an end to go and eat dinner after this talk. You'll have to choose various means to eating dinner, such as figuring out how to get where you're going and choosing what to eat. If you're asked, "Why are you going to eat dinner?" answers you might give include, "I enjoy eating. I need energy. I want to hang out with friends." So eating dinner isn't simply an end of yours. It's also a means to something else, such as energy or spending time with friends. In sum, we pursue ends and means to those ends. But the ends we pursue are also means to further ends. To return to the dinner example, we could ask again why you want energy or to spend time with friends. And we could ask again why about whatever answer you gave. And we could keep asking, and so on. Aristotle observes that there has to be something we treat as the last end, or the final end. something we're not thinking of as a means to anything else, but simply as an end. If we didn't have a last or final end in mind, we would never begin anything. Aristotle says we all agree in general about what that final end is. It's happiness. Let me illustrate in a different way. I suppose I ask you why you're taking courses at this university. You might say because you want a degree from the University of Kansas. I then ask why you want this degree. You might say because you want a good job. I then ask you why you want a good job. You might say so that you can support yourself and perhaps provide for a family. I then ask why you want that. At this point, you may get a little puzzled. If you're like my students, you'll then give answers such as, I want a good life. I want to be happy. If I were to ask you why you want this, you would just say again, I just want it. I want to be happy. We've reached, then, the last end. That last end is a good life, or happiness. Aristotle holds that all human beings desire happiness and that they desire everything else for happiness. The second point is controversial, but Aristotle thinks most people hold it. His line of thought is something like this. When you ask these why questions about the different activities in your life, you'll end up stopping those questions at the same answer. People want a good life for happiness. Ultimately, a person wants to live his best life. If we all want happiness, then it's very important to figure out the answer to the question, what is the best life to live? This question is one, if not the most important question of our lives. Furthermore, if you ask different people the question, they'll give you different answers. Additionally, they might change their answers depending on what's going on in their life. Aristotle considers many different answers before offering his own. And here are five common answers. I'll state them all, and then I'll discuss them each in turn with Aristotle's critique of them. Number one, sensory pleasure. The best life is one with the greatest sensory pleasure. Number two, wealth. The best life is being wealthy. Number three, honor. The best life is winning praise from others for significant accomplishments. Number four, power. The best life is one of power and influence. Five, health. The best life is one of health and longevity. Aristotle does not deny the goodness of pleasure, wealth, honor, power, and health. He acknowledges that they can be good, but having them doesn't guarantee that you'll live your best life. Happiness is something else. Let's walk through his criticisms of these rival accounts of happiness. To the first, he says that a life of sensory pleasures is not enough for us. He says it's a life fit for cows, but not human beings. What does he mean? If we were to ask what makes for a happy cow, we'd probably say that the best cow life requires food, drink, shelter, the comforting presence of other cows, and making and feeding new cows. That's enough for a cow. But a human being could have ready access to the pleasures of food, drink, shelter, society, and sex, and still be unhappy. While these pleasures have their place, to live for sensory pleasure alone is to live as if a cow's life is our own best life. Young human children tend to live for these pleasures and make their decisions based on what will bring them the most sensory pleasure and avoid the most sensory pain. Parents seek to help children to make more than their immediate sensory pleasure their aim. If an adult lives simply for his own sensory pleasure, we act as if something's gone wrong. Mature people will say things like, he never grew up. As an aside, there is of course something admirable about an adult who's childlike. But the admirable trait of childlikeness has to do with humility and trust, to my mind, rather than the childish pursuit of sensory pleasure above all. To the second life of wealth, Aristotle says that wealth cannot be the final end, for it's clearly desired as a means to something else. That is what it can buy, or the security it can afford. People want wealth for houses, cars, clothes, entertainment, travel, education, etc. It's not desired for its own sake. Therefore, it cannot be what happiness consists in. This may strike you as a surprise, given it appears that there are a significant number of people who order their life around accumulating wealth. Some may simply confusedly believe that having lots of money will make them happy. Others may view it as a necessary means to securing other goods needed for a good life, and they haven't thought much about what they will live for after they've acquired the wealth. Some wealth, or another means of access to the goods it can buy, is clearly necessary for a good life. We need food, clothes, and shelter to live. Usually, money is the means of securing those. We do need it, but the best life requires much more than meeting those basic needs. To the third life of honor, Aristotle has two replies. First, pursuing praise for your accomplishments makes you very dependent on others and their opinions of you. But he thinks your happiness couldn't be so dependent on what others think of you. Happiness is much more up to you. We all know of it, and furthermore, we all know of examples in which a person deserving of honor fails to get it, and a person undeserving of honor gets it instead. Second, Aristotle notes that we rightly pursue honor as a means, as a sign of our goodness and the goodness of an accomplishment. A student enjoys praise from a teacher because it confirms her and to her that she's making progress. An athlete seeks praise from a coach because it tells him he's improving. But if honor is a means, then it cannot be the final end. To the fourth life of power, Aristotle levels the same criticism that he gives of honor and wealth. Power, too, is a means. Power gives the potential to do something. It's ordered to the activity the power enables. So the true end is that activity and not the power itself. To the fifth life of health, Aristotle might say that a healthy and fit body is good, but there's much more to human beings than the body. There's the mind, too. Who would want to have a healthy body but be ignorant of important truths or lack friends? Who would want a sound body but a corrupt soul? Clearly, life is more than health. Health is desired for its own sake, true, but health is also a means to pursuing friends and learning truths. For it's much harder to do these things when we're very sick. But if it is a means to these things, it cannot be the final end. Here are some general comments that I want to make about these five that are Aristotelian in spirit, even if he doesn't exactly say them. Each of the above candidates for happiness focus on a good that we typically focus on at different stages in our life. I'm not claiming this is a universal rule. We also desire all of these at various stages in life. But there may be some profit to thinking whether or not people tend to hold these divergent accounts of happiness when in different life stages. When we're children, we tend to think about having the most pleasurable experiences and avoiding painful ones. Pleasure and pain are our guide, and they do a serviceable job. Children don't know better, but every parent knows that she has to check this impulse in her parents and her children sometimes. Otherwise, they'll eat too much candy, run into a busy street, or hit other kids. As we become independent from our parents, we have to provide for ourselves what before we received from them. We now need money to pay for a place to stay, food to eat, and clothes to wear. We become interested in money and feel the need for it in a pressing way that we did not feel when living with our parents. After we get a job that pays the bills and we begin a career or vocation, we tend to focus not just on money but on doing well at our work or in our life outside our work, making personal and professional improvements and accomplishing goals. We start to think about larger accomplishments and the praise that naturally goes with them. We become concerned with honor. As our goals increase in significance and we accomplish them and grow in our knowledge and experience, we develop strong views about how things ought to be and may start to prize power and influence in order to change the world for what we think is the better, at least for us. Power, too, is a good when used well, but it can be abused, too. The supervillain is terrifying precisely because he has great power without true moral vision. Finally, as we begin to see the effects of age, desire the health and strength needed to raise children and grandchildren, and anticipate retirement, the pursuit of health can become a single-minded focus. Whatever the accuracy of my observations about a correlation between a person's vision of happiness and that person's stage of life, these all point to an interesting lesson. The common thread among these examples is that the final end that a person pursues is partly determined, or can be, by their present circumstances, rather than by a reflection on what happiness is within a whole life. Socrates famously said that the unexamined life is not worth living. One way to interpret this is that we have to examine both our own lives and reflect on what the best human life as a whole would be. We need to think of life as a whole, not just the present moment with its needs. When we do so, then we can make a plan to move from where we are now to where our life as a whole ought to be. By reflecting on happiness with Aristotle, he's helping us to live a more examined life, as his intellectual grandfather exhorted. Before examining Aristotle's own account of happiness, we'll now look at two necessary conditions for happiness that Aristotle provides. He uses these conditions to rule out rival paths to happiness, as we've seen. For no account that lacks a necessary condition can be correct. First, he says, happiness must be complete. To be complete means that something is desired for itself and never for the sake of something else. It's not a means. Happiness is the most complete end. It's the most comprehensive. It includes other ends, but is their chief. For example, happiness cannot consist solely in having wealth, because we desire wealth for the sake of other things. Wealth is incomplete, so it can't be what happiness consists in. Second, Aristotle says that happiness must be self-sufficient. By this he means that it lacks nothing in the sense that it satisfies all reasonable desires. He also means that happiness depends largely on oneself, although there is some fortune or chance involved, for example, in securing external goods needed for life, such as wealth. In summary, Aristotle holds that whatever happiness is, it must include living a complete and self-sufficient life. One moment. Let's now turn to Aristotle's account. Aristotle understands the good of something to depend on the kind of thing it is. The good of a cactus will differ from the good of a cow. The good of a cow will differ from the good of a car. The good of a human being will differ from the goods of cacti, cows, and cars. Given that the true account of happiness is the answer to the question, what is a good human life, or what is the best human life, Aristotle's first step is to ask, what is a human being? For he reasons, if he can figure out what a human being is, then he'll be able to figure out what makes a good human being. Once he's determined what makes for a good human being, he can figure out what is a good human life. In summary, Aristotle's view is that the correct answer to the question about human happiness depends on what makes for a good human life, and this depends on what constitutes and promotes the objective flourishing of human beings. He claims that human beings flourish when they perform their characteristic activity well. A characteristic activity of a thing is an activity that characterizes the kind of thing it is. For example, playing the guitar is the characteristic activity of a guitar player. To play the guitar well is to flourish, or to be good as a guitar player. What is the characteristic activity of a human being? Aristotle claims that it's the activity of using our reason. By reason, we come to know important truths and make choices that transcend our instincts. Our reason is what makes us distinct from other animals. Our reason is what brings a governing unity to the use of our other capacities and to our lives. We typically identify more with our reason and choices based on reason than our immediate desires and emotions. Recall the last time you broke a diet out of an impulsive decision. If you berated yourself afterward, wasn't it because you identify more with your deliberate rational choice than your impulsive desire? If the activity of reason is the human characteristic activity, then we'll flourish as human beings when we use our reason well. Using our reason well includes understanding things, making good choices, and fostering reasonable emotional responses regarding the situations and people we encounter and the actions we pursue. Aristotle calls these activities in accord with reason, where reason, or right reason, judges what conduces to human flourishing. Aristotle calls the habits that dispose us to activities, in accord with right reason, virtues. Virtues are good habits of thinking, choosing, and feeling that are essential to human happiness. A virtue is intellectual when it involves a good habit of the intellect, and a virtue is moral when it involves a good habit of choosing or feeling. These habits are tendencies and a bit like skills. They make us able to do reasonable things reliably, easily, and with pleasure, or at least without pain. These are virtuous activities, which are reasonable activities done well, using one's virtues. Aristotle claims that a good life is characterized by such virtuous activity, and that this will be done with friends. Friends are vital for our flourishing because we're social animals who need each other for good lives. Aristotle's basic notion of friendship is that it's a relationship characterized by mutual goodwill, of which both parties are aware, that's based on some likeness between them. The fullest and most complete kind of friends are those we care about for their own sake, and not merely because they are pleasant or useful to us. We say to these friends, "I love you for who you are as a person," not merely because we enjoy doing things together, or because our relationship is mutually beneficial. I'll call these good friends. It's the good friend who will sacrifice his own pleasure or benefit for the sake of his friend. So if we want to summarize Aristotle's view of happiness or of living a good life, it's that happiness is a life of virtuous activity with good friends. His view of happiness has implications for a bad life, which we should seek to avoid with all our might. A bad life is a life characterized by vicious activity, or the habitual failure to use reason well, failure to choose well, and failure to become and be the kind of person that can be a good friend. Aristotle argues that his account explains what's plausible of the other accounts without their weaknesses. He claims his account will lead to an overall enjoyable life. For a person who gains pleasure from doing virtuous activity and characteristically performs virtuous activity will, on the whole, have the most enjoyable and pleasant life. The pursuit of mere sensory pleasure often leads to pain and guilt in the aftermath as we recognize the bad effects of our short-sighted choice for pleasure in the moment. So while Aristotle affirms the goodness of pleasure, he cautions us to be wary of it because we're not impartial to it and it can sometimes lead us to do what's unreasonable. Aristotle claims that virtuous activity may require some measure of wealth, honor, power, and health, depending on the circumstances. For example, practicing the virtue of generosity through hosting a dinner party for friends requires you to be healthy and not in bed with the flu. Finally, let's see how Aristotle's account of happiness answers the objection from the beginning that happiness is different for each person and that it's up to each person to find his or her own happiness. Aristotle can respond by saying that a life characterized by virtuous activity could be lived out in many states of life. A teacher, business person, stay-at-home mom, author, musician, engineer, computer scientist, any of these could live such a life. The wealthy and the unwealthy could walk such a path. Those with power and public influence and those without could do so. They all must live a life of virtuous activity with friends, but the circumstances in which those virtues are exercised will differ according to the individual. Now I'll be a little critical of Aristotle. One common criticism is that Aristotle's view is attainable only by an elite few. Aristotle famously remarks that people without a good upbringing are doomed to unhappiness. The conditions needed for the full development of human potential are not within reach of most people. Should we be interested in an account of happiness that's so demanding as to exclude most of us? One way to modify Aristotle's account is to introduce a degreed notion of happiness, such that we are happy to the extent to which we approximate the ideal he outlines. Keeping his ideal in mind gives a target to aim for. Our lives are good to the extent to which we hit it. So my best life is still one characterized by virtuous activity with friends, but my potential to realize that will have limits. Another criticism of Aristotle's view comes from the medieval philosopher and theologian St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas defends an account of happiness that's surprisingly even more rigorous in its ideal than Aristotle's, but at the same time accessible to potentially everyone. Aquinas argues that Aristotle's own account fails Aristotle's self-sufficiency criterion. Aristotle's account of happiness lacks the perfect fulfillment of all reasonable desire because of evil in the world and ultimately our deaths. We cannot avoid all evil, and it takes some good and some of the goods from our lives. Further, death keeps us from having a good life continually. Both show that not all of our reasonable desires are satisfied even within the best of lives. Aquinas says that only a life without any evil and without death would actually meet Aristotle's criterion. Since that is not attainable in this life, Aristotle's path to happiness is as good as we can manage, but it will only ever be incomplete happiness, not the perfectly best life. Aquinas does think this best life is possible, but it's possible only with God's help. The best life would be one of eternal virtuous activity with the most virtuous of friends. This is just what Aquinas believes Christianity offers: eternal life with God and the saints, knowing and loving and enjoying God forever. Given God's the source of all goodness, if God shares his life with a person, that person will have all reasonable desires satisfied. Furthermore, since with God all things are possible, this best life could potentially be had by all and not just the elite. This would have been good news to Aristotle if he had ever lived to hear it. In summary, Aquinas shares Aristotle's view of happiness, but he thinks that virtuous activity with friends in this life alone cannot perfectly satisfy us. We will still have trouble and face disappointment and death here. There will always be some things lacking in even the best of lives. If we are to be perfectly fulfilled, he says, we must enjoy eternal and perfect virtuous activity with friends, where God is the first and best friend that we know and love forever. Here's a brief summary of what I've said thus far. For Aristotle and Aquinas, happiness goes beyond pleasure, wealth, honor, power, and health. It's living a life that befits and fulfills our nature as rational and social beings. The best life is characterized by virtuous activity with friends. For Aquinas, we can only have happiness imperfectly in this life, but we can have it perfectly in the next life through eternal friendship with God. Let's now apply this view of happiness to our life. We'll be looking at the proper way to view eating, food, and drinking alcohol in a virtuous life with friends. To get a clear picture of the target, we'll focus on the unreasonable or vicious desires for food and drink and their pleasures. To understand the good of food and drink, we must see how they fulfill our natural needs and help us to flourish. This will determine what is reasonable use of food and drink. So let's ask, how does eating fulfill us? The obvious answer is that it provides us food to digest and metabolize so that we have energy for our growth and sustenance. In short, we need food for survival and health. Notice immediately that food is a means. Hence, it would be foolish to live for eating, to act as if the pleasures of food are what can ultimately satisfy us. Given food is needed for our sustenance and growth, we should moderate our desire to eat according to what's needed to maintain ourselves in good condition. This would not imply that we should never fast or feast. Fasting and feasting are good for us in other ways, but we must fast and feast reasonably. For example, eating the Thanksgiving meal isn't ruled out, but eating like it was Thanksgiving every day is. Likewise, fasting helps us to control excessive desire for the pleasures of food, achieve health or fitness goals, or sacrifice that time and those resources for a more noble purpose. But if we fasted to such an extent that we lost the pleasures of eating, we would act unreasonably. To see why, let's look at why feasting is reasonable. That we feast and celebrate using food reveals another good that food promotes, or another way in which food promotes our flourishing. It promotes our social flourishing. Human beings naturally seek to share food together. Reason bids us to make use of our daily bread to grow our friendships and communities. How does sharing food build friendship and community? It can do so in many ways, but one way is directly related to the pleasure of eating. When we are enjoying something together with another person, we're better able to enjoy that other person. Aquinas summarizes this two-part place of the desire for the pleasures of food and drink in The Good Life as follows. So I'm going to just quote from him from his work on evil. Desire for food and drink must be aligned with what is needed to maintain the body in good condition and to enjoy the company of those with whom we live. Now that we see what reasonable desire for pleasure, the pleasure of food and drink, involves, let's look at how we unreasonably desire such pleasures. The unreasonable desire for the pleasures of food and drink is called gluttony. Gluttony is a disordered desire. Such a desire is an emotion that moves us toward the object of our pleasure. It's not hunger. Hunger is a merely autonomic response of our body to the need for food. The hunger can be disordered for reasons unrelated to a disordered desire for the pleasures of food. But we're interested in the desire because it's the desire that can become virtuous. Gluttony comes in varieties, and the varieties may surprise you. Gluttony is not simply eating an excessive amount of food, although that is one kind of gluttony. First, we can have unreasonable desires in eating certain foods. So I'm going to outline these different kinds, which are also on your handout. One of these species of gluttony is called sumptuous eating. This is when we take excessive pleasure in eating expensive and naturally choice foods. You might wonder what would make such pleasure excessive. Well, here's an example. Suppose a student was to invite a professor over for dinner to, say, a barbecue, and they were cooking up steaks. And the professor said, "That's great, I'd love to come. Can you tell me more about your steaks?" And they would say, "Well, you know, I got a great deal on them. I went into Walmart, it was just great. I'm really excited to be able to offer this to you." And he's like, and the professor said, "You know what, I really want to come, but I just love steak, and I really need my cows to be happy cows. So I need organic, free-range, A-quality beef. Do you mind if I just bring my own and cook it with you?" Right? So their attachment to pleasure makes them a jerk. The student is trying to offer hospitality, and the professor is in some way obsessed with the pleasure they get from eating meat, such that they're unwilling to accept a more meager hospitality. You can see how this is an unreasonable thing. And the student would rightly feel annoyed that the professor would say such a thing. So that's an example of sumptuous eating, and you can see its unreasonability. It can be unreasonable in other ways too. For example, if a person were to spend more than they can afford on such food. Here's another kind of eating, and it's called fastidious eating. That's when we take excessive pleasure in eating delicately and skillfully prepared foods. So this can have a couple of manifestations, but here would be an example. Suppose there's a group of friends, they're students, and they have various degrees of access to money. Some have more disposable income than others, some are really just scraping by. And they all want to go out to eat together, and one of them, who happens to have plenty of money, loves the way that some restaurant makes food. It's just, the chefs are great, they prepare the food really well, they just love it, they're so excited about it. So they're pushing the whole group to go to this really expensive, nice restaurant, where they have the food that's just perfectly prepared. And they end up going, and the student that doesn't have money spends the whole time worried about how they're breaking the budget on this thing. They're not enjoying their friends. They're probably not enjoying the food. They're just feeling bad about how much they're spending. Notice what happened. The person, because of their desire for that pleasure and their failure to think about their friend, ended up spoiling a good time, at least for the one person, out of that desire for pleasure. So you can see the unreasonability when we look at it, you know, from above, and we step inside the person or the student's shoes who didn't have really the means to afford it. So that's an example of fastidious eating. The difference between these two is that in the first case, the principal cause of pleasure is the natural good, like wanting the best beef. But in the second, the pleasure is wanting something like a really well-prepared meal because of the excellence of the chef or something. But in both cases, it's excessive pleasure and this kind of eating. The next three are a little different. The next one is called hasty eating. And this is excessive desire to eat such that one eats before the proper time. Now, I want you to imagine it's Thanksgiving, and your mother or your grandmother or other people are making all sorts of great food, and there's, or some other feast, there's lots of dessert, there's all sorts of great stuff, and you're just in the kitchen, you're smelling it, it's all so good, and you're trying a little bit of this, and you're trying a little bit of that, and you're tasting it all, and you're just enjoying it. And then finally, the time for the meal begins, and you sit down at the table, and you're full. You've already eaten enough. And everyone's excited, they start eating, and you're picking at your food. You're hardly eating anything, because you've already eaten enough. And your mom's like, "What's wrong? Don't you like the food?" Like, yeah, it's great, Mom. You know, I just ate enough already. And, you know, here's the thing. What's gone on here? Because the person was so focused on the pleasure of food, they failed to take advantage of what the feast was supposed to do, which is where everyone sits down with an appetite and they enjoy the food together. And so that the whole ambiance, the mood is enhanced because everyone is sharing the pleasure. Whereas the person just had the pleasure by themselves before, they're not no longer sharing it with the group. And so now your mom's asking, like, "Why don't you like it?" And she's feeling bad because she didn't think the food was good. And then when she sees that it's just this other thing, then there's a kind of like, "Oh, you're not sharing in this thing with us." Even though I think we can detect that there's an unreasonability here, even children get it. My daughter, she does like sweets a lot, but she loves eating sweets with us. And she'll wait. She doesn't want to eat it by herself. She wants the whole group to have it. And she gets really upset if somebody's left out of it. And I think she's got a good natural instinct here. She's 7. And I think that this reveals what I'm talking about here with this hasty eating. Eating before the right time, so you're not able to enjoy the dinner properly or the food properly or the meal. Here's the next example. It's called ravenous eating. This is excessive desire while eating. So think of a pack of wolves wolfing down the meat of a carcass. There's no thought for those around them. They're just trying to get it down. So now go back to Thanksgiving. And suppose there's somebody at the table. And once the meal starts, it's them and the food the whole time. The face is down. They're looking at the plate. They finish it. They go for the next one, right, until they're full. They're not looking around. They're not detecting. They're not trying to engage in conversation. They're not seeing how other people are enjoying it. It's just them and the food. Right? It's a kind of animalistic way of eating that is unreasonable when it's in the context of a meal you're sharing with other people. A good meal begins with people focused on the food in order to satiate their appetite at the beginning. So you might say the hunger is curbed. Then they slow down, they look up, and they start to converse with each other. And they extend the meal over time, not eating too quickly, so that they can extend their time together and hopefully have enjoyable conversation. The ravenous wolf, eater just misses that. The fifth kind of gluttony is the familiar excessive eating. And this is when we have excessive desire after we finish eating what's reasonable. So go back to Thanksgiving. You've had a big dinner and the dessert course comes out and there's 3 different pies and you want a piece of every one of those pies. And you end up stuffing yourself so that you're so full that you have to go and collapse on a sofa and sleep it off. The food-induced coma is not the most reasonable way to eat. It's not good for you in terms of your body, but you also miss out on the social benefits of the meal. And so you can see then how gluttony is a lot more complicated. It's not just overeating. It's a sin that can beset thin people too. So from these examples, we've seen how immoderate and unreasonable desire for the pleasures of food undermines the good of community or our own health. Now let's turn to the consumption of alcohol. Drinking alcohol enables us to relax and to enjoy the company of others. Before I say more, I want to state a general principle regarding pleasure. So this is a little bit of an aside, but it's important to keep in mind. We seek pleasure as a remedy for sorrow. Everyone does this, but we do not want to get attached or addicted to a pleasurable remedy because then we'll cease to be reasonable in its use. Because of the pleasures of food and drink, if we're not careful, we can use the pleasures of food and drink unreasonably as a remedy for our sorrows. If we went to it every time we felt lonely or anxious or like that we experienced failure or boredom or whatever, we would end up misusing those things. And this can apply to alcohol and can lead to people developing dependencies on it. As an aside, I'm just going to come back now to Aristotle's view for a moment. Our experience of this principle confirms Aristotle's and Aquinas' view that sensory pleasure isn't the greatest good for us. When we get caught up in some pleasure and go beyond what's good for us, we then beat ourselves up. We recognize that we lost control. What do we mean by that? Well, we were the ones that made the choice to eat or drink too much. But what we mean is that the rational part of us loses control to our desire for sensory pleasure, and we instinctively identify more with our rational part. So even in, I think, our experience of overeating, we can kind of receive confirmation of Aristotle's view that reason is the highest part of us and what makes us distinct. But now let's return to how to think about the reasonable and unreasonable use of alcohol. The proper use of alcohol must also follow the purpose of food and drink. We ought not to drink to excess, such that we undermine our health, and we ought not to drink in a way contrary to the enjoyment of others and the cultivation of friendship with them. Let's think of an application. If a group of friends are drinking together, when have they drank too much? Well, we can ask some questions. Has their conversation deteriorated? Has it become, say, gossip? Has the friendship development halted? Has someone lost control of themselves and begun to act impulsively and unreasonably? Has someone become a burden to the group, such that they're no longer, you might say, part of the group, but just someone to manage, to do damage control with respect to? We could multiply examples endlessly of when a person is no longer a contributing member to the community of friends, or when the community has shifted its focus from what's good for each member of it and what promotes their deeper friendship to something unproductive and less worthy of them. Then the consumption of alcohol has gone too far. It's no longer serving the human good, but is degrading the drinkers. To avoid both these pitfalls, we need to plan ahead and stick to the plan. For example, set a limit on drinks or the amount of food to eat. We also should remind ourselves of the purpose of food and drink. By using our reason well, we can enjoy food and then use that enjoyment for higher social purposes. We're being good stewards of our resources and time when we eat not only to nourish our bodies, but to cultivate our relationships with others and nurture community. Finally, we should make use of our friends. Good friends help us to stay accountable to what's reasonable and to one another. Good friends don't just enhance a meal, they help us to stay on the path to happiness while increasing the joy of the journey. In conclusion, with Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas as our guides, we've explored alternative paths to happiness, evaluated those that are dead ends, and sought to understand a promising path to happiness, that the best life is one characterized by virtuous activity with friends. We then applied this account of happiness to eating and drinking. We saw some differences between unreasonable and reasonable desires for eating and drinking. Hopefully, this exploration has helped you to reflect more on what it would require for your life to go as well as it can as a whole. Hopefully, you have a better sense for what your best life might entail and how you might cultivate your desire for the pleasures of food and drink in order to serve that life. Thank you very much.
We're going to take about 15 minutes for questions, so just feel free to raise your hand.
Yeah.
So, with the different types of gluttonous eating, what really seems to help remedy them is eating with community, so slowing down, realizing I'm going to enjoy my company, realizing it's not all about the food. But are there ways to combat them for like a student's life when you're often not eating with company? You're eating on the go, you just have to eat something so you can make it through your day.
Yeah.
So kind of ways to navigate that besides always trying to make sure you're eating with
community. That's great. So I'm not claiming that every meal you have to have must be with people or with friends. It's not like it's wrong to eat alone. It's just that it's better to eat with others if you can. But yeah, all of us get busy and we just have to eat a lunch while we're working or grab something quick to eat to get energy and get on to the next thing. So I think that in that case, the principal rule is this conducive to my health? And under certain reasonability constraints, right? It might be that the only way I have access to food nearby is if I have these two choices, and neither of them are super healthy, but maybe one's a little bit healthier than the other or whatever. If I get something really healthy, it's way over there, and that's going to inconvenience me and not enable me to, you know, accomplish some other end. It seems fine. I mean, if it's really, it's not that you couldn't eat something, quote, unhealthy in any particular case. You know, heaven forbid I'm like speaking against gelato or something, or some other delicious dessert. It's really a habitual thing. You have to think about what would be reasonable for me to eat, you might say, regularly. Because sometimes it might be very reasonable for us to eat far more than would be good for us normally. Like, especially if we thought we're going to have to go without food for a while, so it might be that we need to eat more now. And so I think these things will change depending on the circumstances. But I think, if you're eating alone, then I think having a plan helps. Because otherwise you're just, oh my goodness, I'm so hungry, the only thing I have is a candy bar. And then if all of a sudden you're eating candy bars all the time, you're not going to be as productive, and you're not going to help your health in the same way. So I think that if you plan ahead, you're like, I know I'm going to get hungry, so I better pack some fruit or something, then that's just going to help you have a better relationship to food. That's my thought. I saw a hand over here. Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about what you said about the self-sufficiency criteria.
Sure.
So Aristotle in 1.7 there, the way I read that is something like, happiness must be the kind of good such that no other good could enhance one's life if you had it. I don't remember him saying anything about it satisfying all reasonable desires. And I'm not sure why Aquinas reads in that way, and I was curious if you could speak to that.
Yeah. So I agree with the way you characterized Aristotle's account. And I am giving a Thomistic spin on it. And I think that what we'd have to do is work out whether or not how we might see Aristotle's account as entailing or implying the Thomistic spin. So if you were to think, okay, happiness is such that you don't need to add anything else to it, right? You've got everything you want with it. Well, one way of saying, well, if you've got everything you want with happiness, then that seems like you've got what satisfies every reasonable desire.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should be a little bit more careful. What I think he says there is that happiness is the kind of good that by itself makes one's life good. That doesn't mean you have all possible goods included in that.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, so I don't know that we have to understand the satisfaction of all reasonable desires as entailing that you have every good, which seems to be what you're suggesting. And I think that what we'd have to do is we'd have to give an account of what's meant by reasonable under certain circumstances, and not just list like all the possible reasonable goods, but what's reasonable for me now. That would be the way I think I'd have to go.
Okay.
Good question.
Yeah.